Welcome to the Faster Podcast by Flow Cycling, the podcast where we talk about anything and everything that makes you faster on your bike. This is episode 31, and today we have nutrition expert Bob Siebehaar joining us on the show. Bob helps athletes learn how to become better fat burners with sound diet and exercise advice. If you want to lose fat, increase muscle, and improve your body's ability to use fat for energy, this episode is for you. Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. All right, Mr. Bob Siebehaar, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. Well, it's I'm very excited to have you on the show. We've been doing some work with the Canadian cycling coach, Steve Neal, on fat max wattage and how to improve that based on training. And as we learned with him, diet is 75% of that equation, and you basically are the master of everything to do with diet and optimizing your fat burning capability. So happy to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. You are based in Colorado. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. Just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
Okay. And do you do any testing or something in Arizona? I thought you mentioned Arizona at one point.
I don't personally. I've got some of my level one metabolic efficiency training specialists. One gal is down there that does testing, but I've got these, I call them level one METs. They go through my certification. They're kind of planted all around the country. And as you mentioned with Steve's in Canada, that some of them actually offer testing, metabolic efficiency testing. So perhaps you may have heard of that. I'm not exactly sure, but yeah, that's
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
I am housed in Colorado.
Cool. And a quick story before we get into this, I just did Leadville. And when I was up there, I knew I was going to interview you on the show. We'd never met in person. And I was walking through the expo with a friend of mine also doing the race. And he had a book. And I looked, I said, man, that book is so good. You have to buy that book. I look up and Bob's sitting there because he was the author of the book. So really cool experience to actually get to meet you in person before the show. Sometimes I don't get to do that. So
I know that was kind of cool the way it worked out, right?
Awesome. Yeah. And actually, just so the listeners know, Bob asked me how my Leadville went. And I think this is the perfect episode because nutrition was my biggest problem at Leadville. I will give a quick recap. The race went really well until about the top of Columbine, which is probably 4.5 to 5 hours into the race for me. And I noticed that something wasn't feeling right. And my nutrition plan going in was to eat a Bobo's bar every 90 minutes and then take salt and water separately. So I personally have never done an event over 4 hours. And I knew that nutrition was kind of this black hole that I didn't know how it was going to work out. Well, it turned out I did nutrition wrong. So I get to the bottom of Columbine, which is probably 5.5 hours into the race. And between Twin Lakes Dam and the base of Powerline is a 20-mile section. And I remember I was looking down at my power meter feeling like I should have been doing maybe 180 to 200 watts. And my power meter was saying 40 to 50 watts. So I tried to get it back together. I got to Powerline. I walked a good portion of that because I was literally doing baby steps with 143 heart rate. So I ended up sitting on the side of the trail for 20 to 30 minutes, which is the first time in my life I've ever stopped in a race. So that was a bit of a humbling experience. But an athlete gave me a SIS gel shot, which was like a miracle elixir. And it actually got me back on the bike. And I was able to finish pretty strong. I think I finished in 10:22. Which, considering a, you know, probably hour and a half to 2 hour meltdown, wasn't too bad of a time. So, anyway, the reason I tell that story is because people know that I was doing the event, and I think that nutrition is such a huge part of these events. And Bob, you're the nutrition master, so I'm really excited to talk about all of that on the show today.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
Awesome. Okay, so the first thing I want to cover are energy system basics, and this show is going to be about burning. You know, being a carb burner or a fat burner in the endurance sports world. And we're going to get into that on a deep level. But I thought it would be helpful for the listeners to get a basic overview of all of the energy systems in the body and how they relate to cycling before we get into discussing specifically carbs and fat. Okay, yeah. So I did a little bit of research. I'm not an exercise physiologist, but let's start with my basic understanding of this. So I think the first energy system is known as the phosphagen system or the ATP phosphocreatine system. Can you talk a little bit about that system and how it relates to cycling?
Yeah, so it's interesting just to preface this, you know, I guess to dispel this myth, a lot of people, a lot of athletes I talk to, they either think they're burning carbs or fat, right? And it's very seldom do you at one time burn one macronutrient, unless it is, as we're entering this energy system discussion, this ATP, what's called PCR system, that is, I mean, you know, you've heard of cyclists and athletes taking creatine, right? So basically they're trying to build up these phosphocreatine stores inside their body. And this is very, I guess you could call it explosive energy. It is energy that will give you about 10 seconds, if you're lucky, maybe 12 to 15 seconds, just of raw power, just maximal sprint. It's finish line sprint. It's really in cycling, it is a finish line sprint energy system. Okay. But again, it's only about 10 to 15 seconds. Some people say 10 to 20 seconds, but the interesting part of this though is explosive energy. It only regenerates. It takes about 4 to 5 minutes to regenerate this system. So if you're thinking about the efficiency of it, it's actually not that efficient, which is why we can't, you know, when we do intervals like max sprint, you know, VO2 max intervals, anaerobic type sprint intervals, we actually need a lot of recovery time, you know, just spinning our legs out in zone one in between them, because physiologically the body just cannot restore those in under 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Okay, yep. Very cool. Now, let's say you've been racing for 2 hours and you've mm-hmm. been using the other systems, do you still have access to that ATP system?
You do.
You go
yeah,
really, really hard. Okay,
it's always hanging out there. So if you were to start a sprint, all out sprint, about 10 to 15 seconds, you max out your ATP PCR, then you go more into your anaerobic system, and then I mean aerobic is always hanging out also, but yep. It predominates. It depends on really the duration and intensity of efforts. But yeah, you'll always okay. have that ATP PCR in your back pocket when you need it.
Perfect. Okay, the second energy system is the anaerobic energy system or the lactic acid system. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about that and how it relates to cycling?
Yeah, so that one is usually, we talk about that up to about 2 to 3 minutes of effort. So a lot of times when people do some either overgeared or higher threshold, supra threshold, even VO2 max, roughly speaking, that's really like when people think of intervals, that's really the energy system most cyclists are utilizing during their 1 to 3 minute intervals. Okay. That's, you know, FTP increasing, that's trying to really, you know, get the IF above 100-120%. That's the energy system. It's interesting though, because it's lack of oxygen, so to speak, and a byproduct is certainly lactic acid. But I think there's also a misnomer that lactate is not bad. It's actually a fuel source that our body can use. But when overproduced, meaning you're producing too much than you can clear, that's yep. when you start feeling like, wow, I need to slow down. And it's not necessarily the lactate that's making you slow down. It's the hydrogen ions.
Right?
The ions associated with that that's actually creating more an acidic relation in your muscles.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the final energy system I think that we use as cyclists is the aerobic or oxidative system.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that one?
That one. So again, the misnomer is, oh, we're only using the aerobic energy system if we go 2, 3, 4, 5 hours. We're always using it. And in fact, if you look at exercise physiology textbooks, it's just in minimal amounts when we start. Like if you're using the anaerobic energy system, there's still a contribution of aerobic. It's just a very small amount until you start getting past that 2 to 3 minutes. But that's kind of the sweet spot in terms of, you know, obviously from a training perspective, trying to improve your body's metabolic efficiency or fat adaptation. But it's also a sweet spot for just training adaptations. And a lot of cyclists, like those are your long rides. Those are, you know, where you're trying to keep your heart rate under a certain beat per minute to try to maximize, you know, a lot of cyclists or coaches relate that into like a zone one or a zone two model. But that's really like the bulk of time spent, especially in base training or preparatory cycle for cyclists.
Perfect. Okay. So here's my level of understanding on this. So My understanding is that the aerobic system uses oxygen to break down either carbs or mm-hmm. fat to produce energy. Mm-hmm. So for clarity's sake, when we hear people talking about being a carb burner or a fat burner, mm-hmm. we are talking about what fuel source, either carbs or fat, is fueling their aerobic system. Is that correct?
For the most part, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. So that's a high level view of that. Okay.
A high level view,
so then. Okay. And then does fueling your aerobic system with carbs versus fat have an effect on the anaerobic system or the phosphagen or ATP energy system that we just talked about?
So the phosphagen ATP, not so much because that's more of a creatine, phosphocreatine based. But the anaerobic, absolutely. That second one we talked about. So usually for that anaerobic energy cycle, it's pulling most, actually predominantly focused on carbohydrate metabolism, glycogen breakdown, glucose delivery to the body, you know, using either glucose and or lactate, pyruvate, as an energy source. So that is predominantly carbohydrate driven. The aerobic energy system is where we actually start to talk about the fat introduction a little bit in terms of supplying energy. But again, here's the thing. We, in the aerobic energy system, we can gather energy from carbohydrate and or fat, and we can train the body either way. And that's the beauty of it. And I love having these discussions with some athletes and coaches who say, oh no, we want to be a sugar burner, a fat burner. I'm like, well, you actually can, depending on the dietary influence that you introduce into your body. So, and I know we're going to get to this, but our body stores carbohydrate and fat in way different amounts, but they're there, right? It just depends on, a lot of people in the past have thought, oh, it's just the intensity of exercise that predominates one or the other macronutrient from being utilized. And it's not. Like you mentioned it early on when you mentioned Steve, like exercise, specifically aerobic exercise, the contribution to that in terms of on the mitochondrial enzymatic level of improving fat oxidation is only 25% of this whole game here. 75% is diet related.
Okay. So if you're a fat burner, let's say you're burning predominantly fat, does that just give you more carbs to use in the anaerobic system, or does improve the anaerobic system as well?
Fantastic question. So there's a little bit of unknown with this because aside from just a few years ago, we weren't able to really measure muscle glycogen aside from doing a muscle biopsy. And I say we, I'm not talking about me. I'm not a PhD researcher in a lab. Like I've had many muscle biopsies on my quads in grad school, but it is not, I'm not doing them, right? Very invasive. And literally you're sticking a needle into the leg and you're snipping away a piece of muscle.
I've heard they're
fiber.
Terrible.
They're not great, right? So recently, last few years, there's been a company that has gotten more of an ultrasound technique of measuring this. I'm not completely comfortable yet with the 100% accuracy of that. The reason I'm telling you this is if we adapt our body into using more of our energy stores from fat as energy, right, we should be able to preserve or i.e. store carbohydrate in the muscle much better, which means if we're using more fat at a higher intensity, higher VO2 max, higher FTP, whatever we want to measure, we're actually letting carbohydrates just sit there until we need them at a certain intensity level. This is what we don't know. We don't know if you're, and I'm not going to talk about the crazy diets like ketogenic, low carb, high fat, because that's definitely not our discussion topic today, but if you are depriving your body of carbohydrates in terms of diet, right? If you are doing a keto or a low carb, high fat diet, it makes sense that you are decreasing your glycogen stores at the same time, right? And that's why I'm not a huge, huge fan of this unless we're periodizing it correctly in an athlete's training cycle. So back to your original question, if we become more metabolically efficient or fat adapted, you will preserve carbohydrate stores more efficiently. What we don't know is how many carbohydrate stores you have versus the athlete who's eating a high carb diet, who's burning carbohydrates like crazy.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Great. Yeah. Okay, so before we get into what a metabolic efficiency point is, can we start by having you tell us why it matters if we use carbs versus fat to fuel our aerobic system? And I think we covered a little bit about that already, but is there anything else that you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's, I grew up not an endurance athlete, right? I grew up a competitive soccer player and have been doing endurance events, triathlon, cycling, ultra running, like all that for 25 years now, right? But here's the thing. When I learned this in university, it was all about putting in as many carbs into your diet as possible, because it was the whole high carb, low fat, right? Athletes need as many carbohydrates as possible. What yeah. we were, and the only reason why, like the, when I first created this metabolic efficiency training concept in the early 2000s, you know, I went back to the research and, you know, metabolism and biochem and everything. And I remembered, you know, because, you know, sometimes you're in college and you're like, yeah, I forget some of the stuff I learned. So, I dusted off my books and I'm like, oh, yeah, the body only stores between 1,200 to 2,000 calories as carbohydrate. And that depends on gender and muscle mass, so size, basically. So bigger guys will usually store more carbs. Smaller guys, smaller girls will usually store less carbs. So there's an issue here, because we store, as we're not talking like elite cyclists, right? We're talking the more the recreational or highly competitive recreational cyclist. We can store 60, 80,000 or more calories as fat. So there's this huge issue here, this huge challenge, and basically saying we store about as many carbohydrates to get us through about 2 to 3 hours of moderate intensity exercise. But from the fat standpoint, if we can actually tap into those fat stores, and we could talk about that a little bit later, we could probably sustain 10 Leadville 100 bike races, right?
It's crazy.
It is. It's crazy. But here's the thing. Nobody knew how to tap into those stores, because all the research in the 1950s, 1960s was done based on exercise modalities. Nobody ever looked at the nutrition intervention of this. This is where I come in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So now that we know why it's important, we obviously have a lot more fat to use to fuel our bodies than we do that. Can you talk a little bit about what the metabolic efficiency point is? Because this is your whole deal, really.
Yep, exactly. So a little bit of quick physiology primer. So in the 50s and 60s, there's this physiological concept called the crossover concept. So this is basically describing the relationship between fat burning and carbohydrate burning from zero intensity all the way up to 100% intensity. And it basically says this. You can pick up any ex-phys textbook and find the same thing that I'm talking about, is it says that ideally, which actually doesn't happen in more than 50% of the athletes that I've tested, ideally you should be burning fat at lower intensities, so really up to about 60 to 65% of FTP or VO2 max. After you go above 60 to 65%, your body shifts or crosses over into more carbohydrate burning. So that's the traditional model, but like I just said, it was only based on exercise modalities intervention. So what I did is I actually added the nutrition part of it, called it metabolic efficiency, because it's truly not the crossover concept anymore, because we've added an intervention of diet essentially. So the metabolic efficiency point is the same thing I just explained. It's where your body crosses, or that point actually happens between fat burning and carbohydrate burning, or that switch. But metabolic efficiency, it's very important to understand, it is the combination of nutrition and exercise, whereas the crossover concept was only exercise driven.
Okay. Yep. Okay. And I think what we'll do in the show notes of this, I think you've got some pretty good examples of this on your website. So what we can do is link to your charts, and you can see that certain athletes cross at different points. So the more efficient you are at burning fat.
Yeah.
Let's say if you just start, you're not very good at burning fat. You may start to, you know, burn carbs at 120 watts, but really efficient athletes can do it way up at 250, 260, or even higher.
Absolutely.
So we'll get some links in the show notes of this, so that people can actually click on your charts and see it. Because when you see it visually, it's actually pretty shocking how much of a difference that it is.
It brings it to life. Yeah, you really get to understand it better.
Perfect. So you use a metabolic efficiency test to find someone's metabolic efficiency point. Can you describe that test for us?
Yep. So when I first created this concept, I didn't really create the protocol. And so I'm a classically trained exercise physiologist in addition to a registered sport dietitian, right? So I actually was a, you know, I went to school for physiology first and then went back to school for nutrition. So I actually, you know, I developed this concept, looked into the nutrition, guinea pigged it on myself with a few of my athletes, you know, changed their diets around a little bit. It wasn't about a year after that until I said, I need to quantitatively prove this, right? I need to, you know, the athletes are feeling better. They're great. You know, everything's great, but if I can't prove this, right? So basically about a year later, I went back to exercise physiology 101, you know, put my hat on. I'm like, okay, I know how to do VO2 max. I know how to do lactate testing. Can I devise a protocol that looks at this? And lo and behold, I did, right? It's called the metabolic efficiency test. It's a very simple, actually, if anyone has had a VO2 max test before, it is the exact opposite of a VO2 max test. So it is a submaximal test. It's actually, besides putting the mask on your face, because we have to collect O2 and CO2 produced and consumed, besides that, it's actually a very comfortable test because it's submaximal. The stages are about 5 minutes in duration, and I never have gone to threshold unless an athlete asks to go or above threshold, because I get the data. Because think about this, the metabolic efficiency test is a nutritional assessment. VO2 max and lactate test, those are our physical assessments, physiological assessments, right? So it's night and day. It's actually enjoyable. It usually takes a little bit less time. It's usually about 30-minute test. But here's to grossly depict how easy this is. Most male cyclists that I test will start out at about 80 to 100 watts. And depending on their level of competitiveness, we might increase between 20 to 50 watts every 5 minutes. Totally, it depends on if they're elite pro or more recreational. But think about, you know, spinning at 80 or 100 watts. Like, I have to start ridiculously low in this test because I don't want to miss this metabolic efficiency point, because I learned my lesson early on. Because I would always, you know, if you came to me and Chris, you're saying, oh, hey, my FTP is 250, I'd say, okay, you know, we should start at 100. But you'd talk me out of that. You'd say, no, 100's way too easy. And then I'd be like, oh, okay, let's start at 150. No, 150 is too easy. What I found early in this game was that I missed the metabolic efficiency point because we were starting too hard. So again, to kind of put this in context, this is the easiest test, physiological test, anyone will ever do from an intensity standpoint. It's actually quite enjoyable.
and with the common diet, so many people are such strong carb burners. You've seen people burn. I mean, some people don't even have the crossover point, right? And that's kind of the next point we can talk about. So when you do the test, there are three different results that you have. You have levels 1, 2, and 3. So can you talk about those a little bit?
Yep. So yeah, in someone, the athlete will always fall into one of those categories. There is nothing outside number or level 1, 2, or 3. So level one is just what you were saying. They're most likely high carb, low fat, low protein, you know, that traditional carb loading diet, basically.
Yep.
They will never cross over. So they start out burning a super high amount of carbohydrate, hardly any fat. Their lines never meet. That is what I call level one. In my practice, and I've done thousands of these tests on athletes from, you know, mostly endurance athletes, cyclists, runners, triathletes, that usually composes about 40% of athletes who I've tested. And it's pretty common. Even with my colleagues who do the testing, they see the same exact thing. And it's kind of sad if you think about it. Like their daily nutrition, their diet is so far off that they're so inefficient in using their fat stores, right? So no bueno, not a good thing, right? The next probably 60 to 70% is that level two, where they do have that, what I call textbook cross. So they have a metabolic efficiency point. So they start out burning more fat, less carbs, and at a certain wattage, they will cross. But here's what I find in almost every single one of the 60 to 70% of athletes I've tested, their crossover or their metabolic efficiency point is at a ridiculously low FTP or power output. Usually
percentage of FTP.
Percentage of FTP, exactly. And that's all over the board. But I will tell you that most individuals have a metabolic efficiency point, most cyclists have a metabolic efficiency point less or lower than their lactate threshold. And my goal is to actually try to get the metabolic efficiency point closer, if not matched, or even above the lactate threshold point, if they have that data, because that's the economical part of increasing efficiency here.
And that's what Steve said in our last show. He said that in an ideal world, I said, what percentage of FTP can you get your crossover point to? Yep. And he said, 100.
Absolutely.
He wants it to be there, right?
Yeah, so exactly. With, it's so basically, tough, but yeah.
Yeah, but you don't start burning carbohydrates until you get to your FTP. So you've got a ton of reserves. You got a lot of matches, if you'll say, to
exactly.
burn.
Exactly, a lot of matches.
So you're not burning any matches on the way up. Okay, right. So then the third type is the last
pretty,
one.
Yeah, that's pretty extreme. So the level three is only about, I'd say, 5, 10, 15% at max. The level three is basically, I call this physical fatigue, basically saying this. They're burning so much fat, such a high level of fat and such a low amount of carbohydrate, they never cross. So this is the extreme, aka fat burner. But here's the thing. This is the cyclist who probably hasn't done a lot of anaerobic training. So they don't have the power in their legs to really push too much. So usually what I see is this is the cyclist who's been kind of toying with the ketogenic diet, toying with extreme low carb, high fat. But if you do that, I don't know if we're going to talk about that, but I'll talk about it right now. If you do that type of dietary influence on your body, you have very little chance of achieving a high FTP in terms of doing intervals. Like there's no way you could do 150% FTP or above for your intervals because you just lack the carbohydrate or the glycogen stores to be able to get that oomph.
See, and this is what Tim Noakes talked about on one of our episodes. And, and that was kind of a controversial episode because he said, you know, you don't really need to eat for an Ironman. You don't need, you know, which is a thing. But in his defense, you can finish an Ironman on that type of diet,
absolutely.
But you're not going to win it, right?
It's all about competitiveness level. And that's what I always tell athletes. So depending on your level of competitiveness, then we have to kind of frame this discussion on carbs and protein and fat a little differently.
Right. And even Team Sky has adopted a lower carbohydrate diet.
Yep.
But around races, they're ingesting more carbohydrates to give them that competitive edge that they need to get through the races. So, you're seeing that with elite level guys.
Yeah, they're periodizing their nutrition. And that's, I remember when that hit the press, everyone was blowing up and my email box was like lighting up. And they're like, oh my gosh, what are they doing? I'm like, relax. Like they're periodizing their nutrition. They do that, altering the nutrition or altering the carbohydrates a little bit, you know, not necessarily in their base training, but I know they did that, but they'll micro periodize their nutrients. So they're trying to get the best of both worlds, because if you do lower your carbohydrate intake, you're going to signal different enzymatic reactions in your body that upregulate or downregulate carbohydrate metabolism. So there's a time and a place for this, but it has to be under the watchful eye of a sport dietitian, physiologist, someone who knows what they're doing. Because like you said, once they got close to the race, I mean, they would do so poorly if they didn't reintroduce carbohydrates at a certain level. It wouldn't even be funny. So again, you're talking about professional cyclists versus, you know, maybe the guy who's trying to do Leadville and just finish. Yeah, we're gonna toot different horns here for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right, let's talk about how changing your metabolic efficiency point can affect how you fuel for races. And I think this is my big lesson at Leadville. So we've spoken about this on the show before, but in endurance events, you are burning more calories per hour than your stomach can physically digest, or I think at least some people are.
Yep.
Can you talk about how improving your metabolic efficiency point changes how we fuel for races?
Yep. So the easiest kind of low-hanging fruit, if you will, way to explain this is, and we kind of opened with this also, if you teach your body to utilize more of its fat stores for energy, that means you'll be preserving your carbohydrates, right? Where this really kind of falls into play here is, and I've seen this, I've measured it. That's the whole purpose of metabolic efficiency testing, or at least one of the purposes is, say, for example, a typical male cyclist is putting down 300 calories per hour on the bike, right? Fairly typical for the most part. It's usually 250 to 350 calories. We'll use 300 calories per hour. Now, if they're doing that, and again, a lot of factors, what if it depends, level of competitiveness, male, female, we get it, right? But if they're consuming 300 calories per hour and it's all coming from carbohydrates, And their FTP, their percent FTP is quite high, meaning it's over their metabolic efficiency point, which it probably is, which we already talked about. They're going to be burning through their internal or carbohydrate stores, which are called glycogen stores, fairly quickly. So they have to try to keep up. But here's the thing. This guy's, you know, if we're using a male, this guy's probably burning 900 to 1,000 calories during that hour also. So there comes a time where if you make your body more efficient using fat, you preserve carbohydrates. Therefore, you actually don't need as many supplemental carbohydrates during the race or during training, because you're actually relying more on your fat stores at a higher percentage of FTP. That is crucial, like a crucial point to take home. But here's something I also wanted to mention, because I kind of coined this term called the calorie intake efficiency ratio. And you can see it on a couple of my slides on my website, but it's exactly what you just said. Let's go back to this guy. If this guy's burning 1,000 calories an hour, there's no way he's consuming 1,000 calories. That physiologically is not possible during exercise, right? Maybe if he was sitting on his couch or, you know, whatever, right? But here's the thing. So I asked this question years and years and years ago. I was like, well, if we can't consume that, like how many can we consume? So I actually did a lot of anecdotal research, basically asking cyclists who used power and heart rates. I asked them, you know, I took hundreds and hundreds of data samples from athletes that I knew, cyclists that I knew, and I basically compared what, you know, their kilojoules being burned versus their intake. So they would report to me how many calories they had per hour on different types of training ride, different FTP, everything. Basically, long story short, for cyclists, I came up with a calorie intake efficiency ratio, which basically means this is what you can put in your body in terms of calories per hour, between 10 to 40% of what you're burning. Now, runners and triathletes, it's 10 to 30%, because cyclists we know can eat a little bit more, because usually not a lot of stomach issues. But so here's the thing. If we can only eat up to 40% of what we're burning, there's a little bit of an energy conundrum, right? So
yeah, that's, it's a war of attrition.
Exactly. And that's why this metabolic efficiency comes in so handy. So a grave example is this, you know, you may start out, if you're a typical high carb, you know, low fat diet guy, you might start out needing to replace 40% of the calories you burn per hour on the bike, right? But as we make you more metabolically efficient or fat adapted, that number decreases significantly, and it usually decreases by about 50 to 75%. I know that's a huge number, right? But I can get someone down to like 10 to 20% of their calorie needs based on what they're burning. And it's in no lack of energy. It's not like they're falling off their bike, right? It's just because they're burning fat at a higher percentage of FTP, we don't need to introduce as many calories per hour. So we actually introduce them very strategically. So like looking at the Leadville course, we would dissect that course and say, all right, if you're metabolically efficient and, you know, maybe you've had the testing and we know where that falls, this is where you need to consume, you know, a little bit higher amount of carbohydrates, because either the altitude and or because the course dynamics, meaning climbs or descents, or even a little bit of flat.
And that's going to help GI issues too, because you don't have all those calories just sitting in your stomach.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so improving your fat burning ability has clear benefits for long distance athletes. Can shorter distance athletes gain any performance benefits from burning more fat? Maybe like a 1 hour crit?
Yeah, here's the thing that I look at. During the crit, absolutely not. Well, I mean, crit is a little bit different. I mean, that's, you're so, like, if you're doing anything nutritionally during that race, good luck, right? I mean, you're not even drinking water. Like, take the cages off the bike. You're not doing anything, right? But here's where it benefits. Like, for cyclists, we start talking about watts per kg, right? Power to weight ratio. And and we, like, I work with a lot of cyclists. So becoming more metabolically efficient, which is basically just manipulating your daily nutrition, that will actually lead to some body weight, body composition changes. And if you're doing the training correctly with your coach, if you have a coach, that should be manipulating your power to weight ratio. So in fact, you're doing some back end work to improve your power for that crit, or your power output for that crit. It's not necessarily, like, for shorter distances, it's not necessarily about manipulating what you're putting in your body during that. It's what you're doing for your body before that happens.
Well, you might get to the start line cheaper, though, because if you're doing a lot of long distance training to get to the crit, you don't have to buy all the food to eat on all your rides.
Much cheaper. Yeah.
Cool. In your books, you've mentioned that a lot of people overeat when training and racing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I refer it to as the eyes are bigger than your stomach. So a lot of times, you know, and this is to kind of come back to the other concept that I've created, this nutrition periodization concept that actually came before metabolic efficiency. And it basically states we as athletes, we need to align, we need to think about our nutrition in terms of our training cycle, right? So what I've seen is a lot of cyclists, when they start their year, you know, usually January, depending on where they are, the type of racing they're doing, you know, if they start in January, it's their base training or prep cycle. They're doing some load or, you know, low volume, trying to build it up, low intensity. That's when I see a lot of cyclists overeating, because they think, oh, I'm back in the saddle again, or I'm doing some indoor training or whatever, and I need to eat a lot. And in fact, the opposite is true. So they're not periodizing their energy expenditure, or kilojoules, if you will, on their energy input or their daily nutrition. So I see a huge mismatch in the early season. Then when they start, and this is the other big snafu, when they actually start getting in some intensity or maybe early season races, they're absolutely over-consuming on the bike most of the time. And that's honestly, it's just because they don't know. Like, you don't know what you don't know, right? So they're right, kind of going based off of, you know, the media, the press. They're not doing some physiological testing on themselves. You know, that's where, like, when the rubber meets the road, you've got to get some testing done on yourself so you understand your body better.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Another thing you mentioned too is, as the intensity of the race increases, your stomach's ability to digest gets worse. And that's because you're losing blood in the stomach, because it's going to the periphery muscles, right?
Exactly.
So can you talk a little bit about that and maybe give us some advice on how we can improve digestion during these higher intensity events?
Yeah, and I would say this, you can't really improve the dynamics of digestion, because it's going to happen. Like, it's called blood shunting. So your blood is going to be shunted from the gut to the working muscles, obviously the legs for cyclists. That's where, and that's one of the beauties of metabolic efficiency, because if you can increase your fat burning, if you will, fat oxidation, preserve carbohydrate, you don't have to introduce a lot of calories during a race or during high intensity training. It's the introduction of calories when the blood shunting is happening that completely destroys your gastric emptying and your digestive response. So even better, like, if you can get away with not consuming 40% of the calories burned, but more 10 to 20%, your gut is going to be extremely happy. But here's the other thing. Remember what you talked about with your nutrition for Leadville. You went from more of a whole food based, and then once you got in that challenging part, you went more towards the traditional sport nutrition product. A lot of times we have to think about the intensity of which we are cycling and what our body can actually process, meaning, is it solid, semi-solid, or liquid sources of calories? So my mantra is, whenever intensity goes up, certainly over your metabolic efficiency point, if you know what that is, or close to your lactate threshold, you need to introduce more liquid calories so they can be assimilated better.
That was definitely my lesson, because I did a lot of my long 6-hour training rides at a little bit easier intensity than I raced Leadville. And I think my stomach was able to digest at the easier intensity. But once I ramped it up, you know, 20 heart rate points, I was in trouble.
Exactly. And that's classic. A lot of cyclists do that. And I call that race simulation training. So during training, at least one or two sessions, like, take a chunk of it. Not that you're going to go out for a 9-hour session and just hammer it, right? But take like 2 or 3 hours of a longer ride and try a different nutrition strategy, because the intensity should be race pace intensity or race pace FTP.
Yep. And I did that, but I think it just wasn't long enough for what I did. So anyway, I tried that, but wasn't successful.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how we change the metabolic efficiency point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have this point. Let's say we're type 2. Mm-hmm. We get on the bike. We actually do have a crossover point, or maybe we're 1. We don't have a crossover point.
Yep.
And we notice that basically throwing our leg over the bike has us burning carbohydrates, right? Yeah. So we're low on that. We're nowhere near FTP, and we're burning carbs.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how we improve that. Let's start with exercise. Now, we just had Steve on our last show, and he kind of went over a much more detailed discussion on how you can use that with exercise. So yep. We won't get too much into detail with that because I really want to focus on nutrition with you. Yeah. But can you just give us your high-level thoughts on exercise and how you can change it with MEP with exercise?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I'm also a coach, right? So we do a lot of zone training, a lot of zone terminology. I'll tell you this though, in all the metabolic efficiency tests I've done versus like field testing too, you really don't know metabolically what zones you should be in until you have it tested via a metabolic cart. So field testing won't do it. Lactate threshold won't do it. Like, you've got to have a metabolic efficiency test done. And this is why I'm opening with this, is because what I have found is most cyclists actually end up training at too high of intensity. So they cannot utilize that 25% contribution from aerobic exercise. So when in, like, if I've got that metabolic efficiency point, I can pick, you know, to the left of that, if you can envision this, to the left of that is where your body's burning more fat. So say your metabolic efficiency point happens at 200 watts, right?
Yep.
Under 200 watts, your body is burning more fat. So the 30,000 foot view is to say, oh, Chris, just train it under 200 watts. But somewhere on that curve, there's going to be one or two sweet spots that are maximizing your fat adaptation exercise wattage. So higher level is, if you know where your MEP is, metabolic efficiency point, you know, train under that, but there's always one or two points that are going to give you more bang for your buck. And that's what we see from the testing. We can pick that out quite easily.
How do you pick that out? What are you seeing?
You basically look at, so if you were to kind of dissect a test and look at like the data I even give athletes, is we can look from stage to stage. We can look at the increase in not only total calories, which is not necessarily what we're looking at. We look at the increase in the calories coming from carb or fat. Then we look at basically the delta between each stages, and we can really pinpoint where the biggest bang for their buck is. So, you know, as an example, maybe they're burning 400 calories in stage one and 500 calories in stage two, but, and I'm going to totally get this wrong because I'm totally just coming up with this, but maybe those calories in stage one, you know, 300 of them are coming from carb and 100 from fat. And then the next stage, it's, you know, 400 from carbs and 100 from fat. Like, there's somewhere in there, there's going to be a very big split, and carbohydrates will shoot up significantly and fat calories will go down significantly. So we basically are trying to find right before that happens. And the great thing about data, and I know you love data, the great thing about it is we can see it when it's happening. Like, that's the beauty of having numbers, is we can actually identify it. We can take the guesswork out of it. So no more asking the athlete, oh, how do you feel? Like, that's still important, don't get me wrong, but having numbers just solidifies this whole thing. So on this example, maybe it's not, you know, 200 watts. Maybe I found, wow, Chris, you know, your ideal is 150 watts. And even though you're burning fat up to 200 watts, burning more fat, 150 is your sweet spot. That's where you should spend when you have your longer training days in the saddle. That's what you should try to hit.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And anything for over that? Like, are you doing any tempo work, or does that improve it as well from your point
tempo
of view?
Tempo work, it actually, from a physiological standpoint, anything that goes above aerobic contributions will not facilitate the contribution of increasing fat oxidation. You're still burning calories, but most of those calories are now coming from carbohydrate once you pass over that metabolic efficiency point.
Okay, perfect. All right, let's get into changing metabolic efficiency point with nutrition, which is definitely your strength. So, let's assume that the athlete has some room for improvement.
Yep.
What, and I think we've covered this. It's basic, but what is the most common dietary problem that an athlete has? Is it that they're just eating far too many carbohydrates?
Mm, yeah, it's that for you
the ratio.
It is the ratio, but it's still happening. It's to a lesser degree because these crazy diets are popping up, but it is because we live in such a high carbohydrate dominant society. And I'm talking the United States of America. For some reason, cyclists think that it's all about carbs. And the paradigm shift I'm trying to give is it's not all about carbs. It's about periodizing your carbohydrates, protein, and fat. So it's about looking at carbs and saying, like, here's a very, very easy way to explain this that really catches people off guard. If any of your listeners eat cereal in the morning or throughout the day, right? Here's how I explain it. the way we are brought up in the United States is when we eat cereal, we get a bowl, we grab the cereal, put the cereal in the bowl, and then we put milk in, and then we eat it, right? Well, yeah. That's the paradigm that I've been trying to change the past 20 plus years. So I know it sounds very, very strange, but the way I teach it is you put the milk in first because that is your protein and fat source, right? A little bit of carbohydrate, of course, too, but that is actually more balanced with nutrients, which we'll get into here in a second, right? Then you put the cereal in. That's one way to actually express the dynamics of changing your behavioral approach to nutrition. So pasta, another great example, right? Cyclists are still doing this, or pasta loading before some stage races, right? Instead of putting pasta on your plate first, if you're not a vegan or vegetarian, put meat on your plate first. So put, you know, if you're at a party or pasta party or whatever, if they have chicken or steak or meatballs or sausage, put that on your plate first, then put the pasta on, because for some reason, cyclists are just forgetting about protein and fat. And that's the underlying issue here. It's not, you know, don't go keto. Like, you don't have to go keto. You don't have to go low carb, high fat. I mean, if you want to, you know, go for it. I mean, that's up to you. That's your choice. But really, we just need to be more sensible in periodizing not only our ratio of macronutrients, but also we need to assume and remember that this is a behavior change. It's not about getting on the bike and getting off the bike. It's about we're facing our nutrition demons, if you will. And a lot of it is based on how you grew up.
Yep. Okay. So we're going to talk about ratios in a little bit, but let's talk about the ratios. What is kind of the ideal ratio of mm-hmm. protein to carbs and fat? Yep. Or, you know, I know you talk a lot about the protein carb ratio. So mm-hmm. talk a little bit about that and what is ideal and where most people are.
Yep. So I won't, I'll spare you with the details of the background of all this, but please know, and for your listeners too, that I didn't make this up. I created it, yes, but it's all created on science. So when I talk about these ratios, it actually comes from diabetes research. So people with diabetes and looking at optimizing blood sugar control. Because that's with metabolic efficiency, the nutrition implication here is really about finding the ratio of carbohydrate, protein, and fat, being able to optimize your blood sugar in terms of not liberating the insulin release from the pancreas too much too often, because that is actually what deters us from fat oxidation. So there's a whole bunch of science behind this. I'm gonna kind of, you know, not get into that unless you really want me to, and I'd love to. But the ratios exist to help people on a simple level, simple qualitative level. So I'm not going to poo-poo the athletes who count calories, count grams, carb, protein, and fat. That's fine. If that's what you want to do, you can do it. I usually don't try to promote it because there are more underlying issues we need to look at first, like intuitive eating, satiety, maybe getting over some, like I call those nutrition demons of how you grew up with food. But basically, the ideal ratio of carbohydrate to protein is a 1-to-1 ratio. That, in research, diabetes research, optimizes blood sugar the highest level that you can. Now, I probably should introduce really what I'm talking about here, right? So I use what I call a hand model, right? One hand is carbohydrate, one hand is protein. Now, the reason why I do this and we can do this is, technically speaking, 1 gram of carbohydrate has the same amount of calories as 1 gram of protein. For all inducive purposes, right? So why don't we talk about fat? Well, if you are not a vegan or a vegetarian, mostly a vegan cyclist, the fat that you are consuming is found in your animal protein sources. So we don't have to necessarily worry about fat. And here's a lot of your listeners are probably thinking, oh, is he going to talk about keto or low carb, high fat? No, I'm not, because that's not metabolic efficiency. Right? Metabolic efficiency training is actually periodizing your macronutrients to support health and performance related goals. It's not necessarily following a diet. Like, this is a lifestyle, but you're periodizing. And that's the hard part for a lot of cyclists is they have to actually increase and decrease their macros. But if it just comes down to this hand model, this ratio, 1-to-1, one handful of carb, one handful of protein. I know you as an engineer, because I've worked with a lot of engineers, it drives them crazy because there are no numbers, right? But that's the point, right? That's the point, is kind of going qualitative, subjective, getting away from numbers for a few, and just connecting with how nutrition feels in their body.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is great. Now, I'm going to go off the topic a little bit here, because I like to experiment with most of the things that we do on the show. So I personally have been trying this diet. So we're gonna divert a few things here, but let's start with I've been doing it for, I don't know, a week and a half, 2 weeks. So let me talk about my experience a little bit. And then I think what that may do is help fill in some of the problems that maybe people experiencing the diet or experimenting with the diet may have. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I am an engineer, so I totally get the hand model. It's simple. The first question I have for you about the hand model is, does it matter what the carbohydrate source is? So if you have brown rice and vegetables, or just vegetables, or white rice versus brown rice, etc.
So yes and no. From a quality perspective, nutrient density perspective, absolutely. Well, there's also, and it depends. If a cyclist has a weight loss goal, we try to reduce the starchy carbohydrates and really the vegetables, right? So we try to reduce sweet potatoes, and we try to reduce corn and peas, and try to get more of the nutrient dense but lower calorie veggies in there. But when it comes to like what you were saying with brown rice or, you know, that kind of thing, qualitatively, no. Quantitatively, okay. No, because you're still like, you still have that 1 gram of carbohydrate as roughly four calories versus the protein. So yes and no, it gets a little bit deeper than that, but I think for what you're introducing, no, that's fine.
No. Okay. Okay. So second question, if you have more protein than carbohydrates, is that bad? Let's say you have a 2-to-1 protein to carb ratio. Is that bad?
My first question to you would be, what is your training cycle, right? So here comes that nutrition periodization. So I'm assuming, because it was post-Leadville, that was during recovery, or what I call transition cycle, right?
I actually started when I started training again. So I'm back in a base phase.
Okay, base phase. Okay, yep. Perfect. So I would say, based on that and based on my assumption of your energy expenditure and your training during base training, I would say that's totally fine. As long as you feel like you're meeting your energy needs, which again, I'm making the assumption that probably most of your rides right now are zone one, zone two, maybe a splash of tempo every so often, right? But that
tempo maybe once, twice a week.
Yeah. So that, as long as, and here's the thing, like as long as your training sessions aren't longer than 2 or 3 hours, you're totally fine. Absolutely. And in fact, here's another, you know, monkey wrench. If you actually wanted to change your body comp, or maybe, you know, manipulate your body weight, that's actually a pretty darn good ratio. And this is the ideal time of the year before you start adding a lot of intensity. Because once you start adding intensity, you need to kind of facilitate more of that 1-to-1 ratio carb to protein. And then when you're in the heat of training, which I didn't discuss earlier, you can actually go up to a 2-to-1 ratio carb to protein and still control your blood sugar quite well. So I do what's called a microcycle periodization with some athletes, and I'll pick apart their week. So say, you know, say for example, you're the typical age group cyclist, you stack your Saturday and Sunday, right? So we know it's long volume or high volume, maybe some intensity in there. And those are the days where I actually might give you a 2-to-1 ratio, whereas maybe the Monday through Friday, after I understand your training modalities, maybe that's more of a 1-to-1 ratio. So, okay.
So you can still improve body weight and composition on a 1-to-1, right? You don't
need huge, the... huge. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I am an engineer. So I got one of the apps on my phone and looked at everything, because I really wanted to understand this so that I could explain it to listeners or anyone who asks me. So I took a typical day and of what I ate before I started this diet, if you will, eating lifestyle, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And I was 50% carbs, 15% protein, 35% fat. So it was a 3-to-1 ratio, or a little bit more of carbs to protein. Mm-hmm. So I started by trying to go to a 30-30-40. So 30% carbs, mm-hmm. Protein, carbs, fat. Okay. The first thing that I noticed, the first few days of it, is I was starving.
Yep.
Like the entire day long, all I could think about was food. And I had a 3-hour ride. I burned 2,000 calories on it. I ate 4,500 calories that day, but I was literally starving all day long. So, but now that it's been a week, I guess, the hunger is really not there anymore. Mm-hmm. So even on short rides in the beginning, like an hour and a half easy ride, 30 minutes in, I was like eating my arm. So is that the adaptation? Is that my body starting to switch? Because now I'm not experiencing that.
Yeah. And there's, so let me preface this by saying there's absolutely a difference between not only gender, but there's also a genetic influence there that, that is just starting to be known. There aren't many implications or even any data we can strongly associate with that yet, but it's starting to be studied a little bit. That said, we know there's at least a 3 to 7 day nutritional adaptation change, mostly because if you think about it from a simplistic way of looking at it, from entry to exit, which basically means digestion process, right? When you introduce a food to your body until the time it does its thing and exits finally, that could be 2 to 3 days. So when you're talking, like, it's like nutrition, this is why nutrition takes a lot longer to change than does training. Like, you can hop on and off your bike pretty quickly, right? Or get your session done in your finish for the day. But nutrition, there's usually that 3 to 7 day adaptation phase. In the keto world, I've got a good finger on the pulse in the keto world because, you know, I usually end up dispelling a lot of that stuff for athletes. But in the keto world, where you're like significantly depleting your body of carbohydrate, that could be 6 to 12 months. As an adaptation. Wow. But from what you do, usually I give as a buffer, I do a 7 to 10 day adaptation process. So within those days, I actually don't like your training to be that focused. I like it to be a lot of zone one, zone two, not that long, because I know that's going to happen. And it does with every single person.
Getting super hungry is normal.
You know, it is what usually ends up happening when you have these macronutrient shifts is you just end up under eating the nutrients that actually make you fuller longer, and that's protein and fat. And so, but if you kind of stayed on that, those percentages, then yes, it's truly the adaptation process, but there might be a time where you know, and I don't know, cause I haven't seen the numbers, but based on what you said, there might be a time where you just underfed calories. It could happen. Yeah.
Okay. So here's my next question. I'm on my big day, I ate 4,500 calories just to break even, right? Because I'm not really trying to lose weight. I'm kind of where I want to be. Mm-hmm. In order to do that with a 30-30-40 ratio, I had to eat 250 grams of protein, but I only weigh 150, 55 pounds. So that's probably too much protein. Is that correct?
Do some quick math here. It's definitely on the higher end. So that's, you know, I think metrically, because that's what a lot of the research is done in. So usually for protein, endurance athletes, endurance cyclists, we could consume about 1.2 to about 2.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. What you just reported was about 3.5 grams. It's not ridiculously high. Like, I've still seen studies in the 3.5 to 4 grams per kg. It's definitely high, don't get me wrong. But that's where I would have probably dropped your protein and introduced more fat. And that's probably
and that was my question.
Yeah.
That was my question. So on these big days where I need to eat 4,000 or 5,000 calories, your recommendation would be to keep the protein and carbohydrates more in that 1.2 to 2.0 grams per kilogram. And if I need the additional calories, if I need the additional calories, add it in fat.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can push your protein a little bit higher. Like I said, maybe 2.5 grams per kg. Carbohydrates is going to be a little bit of a moving target depending on what you're eating on the bike. But fat should be the makeup of those calories in your experiment for sure, because that's probably why you're getting so hungry, or why you were getting so hungry.
Okay, and what are some good sources for that? I mean, you can't just drink olive oil by the cup.
I know. So like, although I've had athletes do that, coconut oil. They were like downing coconut oil. I'm like, oh, that's disgusting. Really?
Yeah, I know. Okay. So what would your, like, as an advice, if I just need to get a lot more calories with fat, what's a good food source that you use for that?
To be honest with you, nuts, as long as you don't have any allergies, nuts are a huge bang for your buck because they're so calorie dense. and they're predominantly more fat than they are carb or protein.
They are. Yeah.
Easy peasy, like nut butter packets, you know, nuts in general. That is like an easy go-to. If you're talking about quick and easy, obviously any animal proteins, well, almost all animal protein sources will have fats. You talk about meats, you talk about cheeses. So it kind of depends on when you're talking about crafting it during the day. Like, do you want to just add some to your lunch, or, you know, do you want to have like a snack? Or if you're just trying to add total calories that are more fat based, then that would absolutely be, you know, nuts would be my top choice for sure. If you don't want to guzzle some oil.
Yeah, yeah, and you could do whole fat cheeses and cottage cheese. Yeah, cheese has been my friend.
Doing, yeah, you yeah. should. And just so your listeners understand this, if you're eating like yogurt or cheese or cottage whole cheese fat. Or any whole, like full on, like go for it. Don't skim there.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. All right. Before we get into your models, which are brilliant, mm-hmm. we can talk about them in a minute. But I do want to go back to one point that you made about blood sugar control. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of talk lately about how controlling your blood sugar is, well, we all know that it is connected to type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. right? And my general understanding is, let's say you take a tablespoon of just table sugar, okay, mm-hmm. you eat it. The sugar is not necessarily bad, but what is bad is the sugar causes a increase in your blood glucose level.
Yep.
Your body responds by having your pancreas secrete insulin, which controls that blood sugar rise. The problem with that is if you eat a diet high in sugar for a long time, you exhaust the pancreas and eventually the cells in your body become unresponsive, if you will, to insulin.
Correct.
Right?
Insulin resistance.
That's how type 2, insulin resistance.
Yep.
Now there's new talk about type 3 diabetes, mm-hmm. where you have insulin resistance to the neurons in the brain, which yes. is linked to Alzheimer's disease.
Yep.
Same effect, right?
Yep.
Okay, so my question is this. Let's say you cut table sugar out of your diet 100%, but you're eating a diet that is 4-to-1 carbs to protein.
Yep.
You're still getting the blood sugar increase because of that carb to protein ratio. You're Bingo. Still getting the insulin response. Are you still susceptible or putting yourself at a higher risk for these type 2 and type 3 diabetes as well?
98% yes. The only 2% okay. that could be argued is if those are super high fiber carbohydrates, and fiber is usually somewhat indigestible in the colon digestive tract. So that usually doesn't, like, when I counsel athletes, I say, you know, with your carbohydrate sources, you got to have high fiber because it helps all these processes. Number one, it helps actually control the blood sugar response. So,
okay.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because this, you know, athletes, individuals, anybody, they need to really be aware of this type 3. They really do, because it is rampant right now. And I predict in the next 5 to 10 years, it's just going to be ridiculous.
Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And so when you say high fiber sources, like if you have a hamburger with a bun, the bun's not a high fiber source, right?
It's really
nachos,
hard.
They're yeah. not a high, right? No. Like none of that stuff counts, does
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And let's talk about that. Like most people, like when I ever give my little presentations to athletes and, you know, I just talk about, oh, hey, what are high fiber foods? And they're like, oh, fruits and veggies. I'm like, yeah, it's good, right? Don't get me wrong. It's good. But like whole grains, and that's what you're getting to, whole grains are not necessarily are the breads and the rices and the pastas you're seeing in the grocery store. Like whole grains are these foreign terms that nobody knows about, things like triticale and bulgur and sorghum. And they're like, what is that? And like, that's whole grain. Like the closer we can get to those whole grain sources, the higher fiber we have. Unfortunately, because we live in our world, we are so inundated with processed and refined carbohydrates that have very little fiber and actually contribute to quite a high blood sugar rise for most of the time.
Okay, so is barley a better example?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
Barley, farro. Yep. Absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, that's great. That's been a topic of discussion. My brother and I have been talking about that. My brother talks about it a lot, so I just kind of wanted to cover that one because I think a lot of people don't understand that. They're like, well, I'm not eating sugar, but...
Exactly.
So, but there's still, you could still affect your blood sugar even if you're not eating sugar.
Absolutely. Okay. And it is. It's all about the ratio, like you mentioned.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. we've talked about the hand model. You have five or six different ones. We're not going to get into all those because some of them are more difficult.
Yeah.
But and Rita's book, honestly, your books are incredible. I've read all three of them.
Thank you.
You have more than three, but I've read them. We'll get into that later. But you also have something called periodization plates. We'll talk about that a little bit.
That's more of a visual model that I really, I kind of put that into my nutrition periodization, explanation basically, but it's more of a, like a lot of people I found are visual learners. So I put it on as a plate example. So basically you look at the plate you eat on and you're in very simplistic terms, you're manipulating the proportions of whole grains, protein and fat, and then the color rich foods, which are fruits and veggies. And based on the periodization or training cycle that you're in, for like yourself, great example, you would actually reduce the whole grains, have the fruits and veggies be very moderate, and then you would try to maximize the protein and fat right now because of the training cycle you're in. The energy expenditure simply does not necessitate a high energy intake, especially from carbohydrates. But then, give it however many months until you get into your intense phase, then the proportions on that plate shift. So now maybe you're introducing more fruits and veggies, and maybe you're introducing a little bit more whole grains while your protein and fat go down slightly. So that's okay. The periodization plates is basically a real time depiction of how food is put on your plate, but it's all based on your energy expenditure needs of your training cycle.
Perfect. Okay. Now for the numbers geeks, I know you're not huge on numbers, but for guys like me, I think we've covered this, but is it safe to say that as long as you get your protein requirement for the day, try and match that with carbohydrates and fill in the rest with fat?
I think that's a really good explanation of it because you simply cannot overeat protein. You'll get so full so quickly, so easily that it's really hard to overdo it without getting sick.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
All right. Can you give us your best advice for timing meals around training at different times of the day? So let's say you're a morning workout guy, mm-hmm. or you're the guy who does your workout right after work at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
How do you time meals around that?
So a lot of it kind of depends on two or three questions beforehand. One is what training cycle are you in? The other is what is your objective for that training session? So say the athlete wakes up at 0:30, they hop on their trainer, it's still dark outside, maybe they're just doing some aerobic foundation work, zone one, zone two. I would tell that athlete, hey, if you wake up and you're not hungry, just hop on the bike, grab some water, start hydrating, and then eat breakfast right after. Contrast that to someone who wakes up at 0:30 and says, oh, my coach has me doing this 90-minute tough interval session, maybe it's a FTP boosting session. Then I would say, all right, that's a very important workout, meaning performance enhancing. You need some type of calories beforehand, and beforehand should probably be 45 to 90 minutes before. So it kind of sucks, right? Because they have to wake up a little bit earlier. What usually ends up happening is these athletes try to structure and say, oh, I'm not going to wake up earlier. Maybe I'll shift that important training session to later in the day when I'm more nourished. So a lot of it does depend on what you're trying to accomplish, the training cycle you're in. And then obviously, like if it's a later in the day session, it really if I don't know the answers to the questions I just posed, there's no way I can answer your question, right? Because if someone says, oh, hey, I'm going to go out for a ride after work at 6 o'clock and I'm going to go a couple hours, I still need to know what training cycle you're in and what your goal for that workout is. If you're going to be pushing tempo or a zone four threshold and above, then all right, we're going to introduce some type of decent snack at probably 4:30, 4 to 4:30-ish to get you enough energy to be able to hit the power numbers you want.
Maybe at a 2-to-1 ratio instead of a 1-to-1 ratio.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So now you're understanding that microcycle periodization a little bit more. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So if maybe as a general, I'm not going to make you, write this down as gospel, but if it's more of an aerobic easy ride, a 1-to-1 ratio to fuel yourself, if it's a harder threshold ride, a 2-to-1 ratio might be wiser.
That'd be a good way to explain it for sure. Yep.
Okay. You hear a lot of people talking about fasted training or starvation training. They wake up in the morning and instead of doing a 1-to-2 hour ride, they're doing a 3-, 4-, 5-hour ride, but no food. What are your thoughts on this?
There's scientific proof that fasted training will upregulate some processes at the mitochondrial level to improve fat burning. So absolutely, 100%, we know that is valid. However, it can also negatively affect hormonal status in males and females. Males, obviously, a little more testosterone-based. Females, I've seen a little bit more thyroid-based. So people, like, I'm okay with, hey, you wake up every so often and maybe once a week, maybe even twice a week, and you're not hungry and you want to do a longer ride and you want to do it fasted. All right, that's like fine. That's totally fine. But if it's strategically placed and too often, that's when I start seeing some pretty negative effects in terms of the hormonal responses.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. Let's talk about fueling while training. Let's go with training, and then maybe we can talk about racing. I think racing is just a higher intensity, so maybe a little bit more calories. But let's say you've got a long weekend ride, 4 hours or something like that, versus a maybe 1.5 to 2 hour training ride. That's a little. So let's do an easy intensity long ride versus a harder intensity shorter ride. What are you having athletes eat during those rides?
Well, it depends on what they want to do from a nutrition standpoint, like metabolic efficiency standpoint, right? So I would love for them on that easy, longer ride, I would love for them to wake up, have, you know, if it's a weekend ride, right? Have a sensible breakfast that is more like that 1-to-1 ratio, put a little fuel in their tank. And then depending, you know, a lot on terrain, obviously, if it's not too hilly, if they could just strategically use a very low amount of fuel during that ride, meaning like, I would say something around the nature of, you know, 50 calories every hour and a half or so, just enough to kind of prime that pump. So you got to remember, like, one of the basic premises of those type of rides is to not only improve your aerobic energy system, but it's to also to improve your fat adaptation response, right? So the more carbohydrate you put in your system before and during, the less fat adaptation response you're going to have. So I don't usually like to have them go, you know, 4 hours with no calories unless they can do it. And I've actually trained some athletes who do that quite frequently. I don't want them to do that in the beginning because they haven't prepared themselves. But I will tell you, after your adaptation phase, you could start experimenting with that and just having water and maybe, you know, a little splash of electrolytes if you need them, which I doubt you would based on that training cycle or that goal of that ride. So it's not necessarily about starvation training. It's just about getting the fuel that you actually need for that training session.
Okay. So now that we're on the long topic, so let's say now you're doing a 4 hour, 5 hour, you know, Gran Fondo, you're racing hard. Yep. How are you fueling them then?
Well, that's where carbohydrates come in really, really handy. Like if the performance level is high, level of competitiveness for them is like super high, like they want to do well, they absolutely need carbohydrates. But here's the thing I can't answer: at what frequencies, right? And what amounts, because we don't know the efficiency of that athlete.
Until you test them.
Exactly. Maybe they're more metabolically efficient, so they only need 50 calories from carbohydrate per hour, or maybe they're metabolically inefficient, so they need 300 calories per hour. But we know this, the frequency of carbohydrate delivery must be scheduled. The quantity is somewhat unknown until we know either they're tested or we can kind of ask some questions like, you know, what have you done in past rides? What kind of calories are you consuming? So you can kind of extrapolate it based on some Q&A, but it's better just to have the test done.
What's your frequency that you like in those races?
You know, if you're using simple sugar-based products, you have to dose about every 30 to 45 minutes. If you're not doing simple sugar, you can go more like 75 to 90 minutes, which is obviously my preference personally.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So after exercise, people often eat carbohydrates right away to replenish their glycogen stores. You don't like this idea. Can you explain why?
I just love it. I love this because it's unfortunately that media has not, well, probably media doesn't know either. Here's the thing. Let me open it up with this. In science, here's what we know. This is hardcore science. It's proven research. We can actually restore glycogen stores within 16 to 24 hours post hard ride or hard race, just on your normal daily diet, which means this. If you don't have an important session in the next day after you get off that bike, you don't need to rush any time in getting carbs into your body immediately after a session or a race. You simply don't need to. In fact, if the goal is more weight body composition focused, you probably should not introduce a lot of carbs post-race or post-hard training session, because all that does is it actually blunts the fat burning response. But here's the other thing. Like, you look at the tour riders, right? What's happening? Well, they've got to bounce back every single day.
Yeah.
They need to shove the carbohydrates in their body after they get off the bike. So, you know, if one of your listeners is like, you know what? Yeah, I'm doing doubles, or, you know, if I've got multiple stage races or whatever that happen within that 24-hour window, yeah, you better be introducing a pretty good amount of carbohydrate immediately. And that's within that 30 to 60 minute window when you get out of the saddle.
And what ratio would you have them eat then?
Usually higher? I do like a 3-to-1, maybe a 4-to-1. If they want maximum, like, quick glycogen reabsorption, we're talking like 4-to-1 ratio of carb to protein.
Okay. And that's not enough to get you out of fat adaptation. That's just...
It won't knock you out. It'll significantly lessen, but it won't completely knock you out.
Okay.
Yeah.
So since we're on that topic, what's your thoughts on carb loading before a race? Like, can you change how you eat a few days or weeks before a race to gain all these benefits? You hear some of these guys who will literally eat like thousands and thousands of calories of carbohydrates before a race.
Yeah.
Does that work?
Well, so I'll tell you, past research, like when I grew up in university, at least, we knew that a 5-to-6-day carbohydrate loading regimen was the thing, right? That was good. It increased glycogen levels. What they've come to find, and this is probably 10, 15 year old data now, is that we can actually accomplish the same thing within 24 to 36 hours. So it's great news, because you don't have to feel like you're gorging yourself for a week. But here's the thing. This is what I always tell people. If you're following a high carb, low fat diet, you better be eating carbohydrate like they're going out of style before a race, because when you eat more carbs in your diet, you're burning more carbs, which means you're always in a deficit, right? But in contrast, if you're more metabolically efficient, you know, sparing your carbohydrate stores, storing them a little bit more, all you need to do within that 24 to 36 hours pre-race is just add a few more servings of carbohydrates. So a little bit more, usually I go fruits with athletes, just, you know, maybe 3 or 4 more servings a day in a day and a half leading up to a race. That's really all it takes. Because think about this, if you're metabolically efficient and you consume, you know, 1,000 grams of carbohydrates more than you're used to, you're going to actually start to change your oxidation rate of carb to fat. It'll be very tough to change that within 24 hours. But you can start to facilitate that change. And that's the last thing you want to do if you've spent all that time trying to be efficient.
Yeah. So if you're doing like a 1-to-1 primarily, maybe the day before a race, would it make sense to do a 2-to-1?
2-to-1 would be perfect. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's actually what I end up doing with athletes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Perfect. All right. Does having a better diet like this 1-to-1 ratio, this balanced diet, does that also allow our bodies to adapt better to the training we give it?
Go a little bit more with that question. I don't know if I understand that fully.
Okay. So by eating a better diet.
Yeah.
Better
meaning defined as more metabolically efficient or?
Metabolically efficient.
Okay.
Right. So we're getting a better ratio of carbohydrates. We've changed our diet. We've improved our diet. And then we go out and we do our tempo rides and our endurance rides. Does our body, since we're feeding it a better diet, does it respond and adapt better to the training that we do because we have a better nutritional strategy behind it?
I don't think there's an easy answer to that. What I'm thinking is, like from the standpoint of, I'm thinking different markers, right? So can we impact the inflammatory markers better, which would therefore produce better training adaptations? Absolutely, hands down. Improve the body's ability to utilize and store glycogen and fat better, which would eventually, you know, I don't think it's a direct correlation. I think it's more indirect. But I guess the simple answer is yes, but I think it's probably not in the way you're asking. I think it's more at the cellular level, really based on the inflammatory responses.
Okay. We've talked a little bit about the benefits of this diet. It helps reduce types of diabetes, the type 3, the type 2. Mm-hmm. We've also talked about improving your your weight and your body composition. Are there any other health improvements that you see with this?
Oh, a ton. I mean, aside from body weight, body composition, everything you mentioned, blood lipids is a big one. So we're talking about triglyceride and more of the in-depth factors of cholesterol, like the particle size of LDL, particle size of HDL. Those can be impacted greatly when you control your blood sugar better. There are a lot of links to inflammation, to obviously like a lot of the health markers, obesity, inflammation, other certain diseases like any inflammatory disorder, such as IBS or even like rheumatoid arthritis. So there are actually a lot of spin-offs from the health side of things, not just the athletic side of things, in terms of trying to optimize and regulate your blood sugar better.
So tendinitis would be one of those as
tendinitis,
well.
Tendinitis, absolutely. Any type of inflammatory. Okay. Yep.
So not only does this help you be a better athlete, it also just helps you be a healthier human being in the process.
Well, and as I tell all athletes, like, you can't perform if you're not healthy, right? So this actually, like, health comes before performance when I look at it from a sport dietitian perspective.
Okay. So in one of your books, you said that looking healthy doesn't mean you are healthy.
Oh yeah.
You talked about blood tests.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you said there's certain blood tests that you recommend. Is there like as a typical panel what we should be looking at, or what are some?
Yeah, a lot of doctors won't do it because it's a lot of add-on. So I like getting, you know, the normal thing that you'll get in with a doctor is called a CBC, complete blood count. And it's fine. It's great. As a sport dietitian, as an athlete, I'm like, well, it only gives me not even half of what I need. So, you know, I need blood lipids, like at the micro level, like I just talked about the particle size. I need vitamin D. I need iron stores. I need B vitamins. I would love a genomics test to kind of see if you have different genetic on and off switches, if you will. So those type of things physicians don't like ordering. Not only are they more expensive, but it usually just requires a little bit more blood being taken. But those for athletes like your listeners, you need to get those tested at least once a year. At least like vitamin D and iron for sure, especially if you're a female, for sure. Just like if you don't pop your hood, I call it popping the hood, right? If you don't understand what's going on in your body, then how are you going to address any deficiencies, right? And especially as you age, right? Every decade, or maybe even every 5 years, your body goes through some major biological processes, especially for your listeners who are, you know, engaging into that 40-year, 50-year, 60-year mark. Like, stuff happens, right? So we need to constantly be on top of our not only blood markers, but other biomarkers inside our body.
Okay. We talked a lot on the show about increasing fats to fill in calories and things like that. There's good fats and bad fats. What fats do you want to see people eating?
I would challenge you and say there's not necessarily good and bad. There's beneficial and less beneficial. So if you are predisposed to a certain disease where maybe saturated fat could have a huge negative effect, then it's bad. But the fat research landscape has been changing quite significantly. So what we know is actually saturated fats aren't the quote unquote bad guy anymore. I mean, obviously we still want to limit them, but our cellular matrix still is encompassed with saturated fats. Here's the thing that this is my latest kick on fats, is we've got, you know, we've always classified bad fats as like saturated and trans fats, right? And then the good fats as poly and monounsaturated. Well, the interesting thing is, a lot of athletes, here's my little secret, and like I said, the bandwagon I've been on lately is looking at the types of vegetable oils, because even though they are quote unquote polyunsaturated, which most consumers think is healthy, if it's an oil like safflower, sunflower, corn, those are actually high
canola.
Yep. Those are high inflammatory fats, but they're still in the category of these polyunsaturated fats. So I would say more, you know, try to focus more of your daily nutrition plan, your diet, and get away from these vegetable fats. Those, if you were to classify bad in that term, that's how I would classify those right now, is those inflammatory fat, inflammatory oils.
I forget whose book I read on this topic, but they're saying that your EPA to DHA, I think those are the terms, the ratio of that per day, if you can keep that at a certain level, you reduce inflammation in your body.
Exactly.
And if you eat these like canola oils, you just throw that ratio way up.
Absolutely.
That's why grass-fed beef is so big, wild-caught fish is so important, because those ratios are right in that.
Absolutely.
Do you recommend supplementing with fish oils and things like that?
Oh, I think, you know, I'm not a huge pill pusher, so to speak. I will tell you this, though, without any testing, I think almost everybody should be consuming some type of omega-3 fatty acid. Okay. Absolutely, hands down.
Okay, perfect.
Yep.
Last question before we get to our watt point question. Yeah. Do you have any advice or thoughts on hydration? Outside of the norm? Maybe that's like a loaded
Loaded. There is so, like, talk about a changing landscape, right? Oh my God, the hydration and electrolyte. How do I even start with this one?
Just give your general 30,000 foot view.
30,000 foot view. I believe we walk around in a dehydrated state most throughout the day, and then we try to make up for it while we're on the bike, right? So some people are better than others, but here's the thing. I just think more individuals need to pay attention to hydration-based strategies with their food in addition to beverages, rather than just focusing on carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Is that a safe response?
Say that one more time.
Yeah. So really focusing on hydration principles that actually include food sources, instead of just saying, like, your experiment, right? Your experiment was, you said, I'm just focusing on carb, protein, fat. Here are my ratios. Here are my percentages. But I didn't hear you really talk about hydration much, right? So that's what that's what I'm still seeing with athletes still in this space, in the cycling space, and actually just endurance in general, is they're not putting hydration on top of the priority list, like they're putting their carb protein ratio, their diets, their whatever you call it. Like, it's still a very, very low priority concept. And I think it needs to be sitting much, much higher than where it is right now. That would actually probably curb a lot of the issues we're still having with hydration.
Huh. Do you have any general recommendations?
Generally speaking, I think if you can urinate, you know, outside of a disease state, if you can urinate every couple hours, you're doing pretty good with your hydration throughout the day. That's my total 50,000 foot view.
Okay, perfect. All right, so we have this question on the show. It's called the Watt Point question. And the idea is, if the listener takes all of the advice given by the expert on the show, mm-hmm. how many watts is that worth? And we always do it based on a 300 watt FTP athlete. So just to give you a concept of where that athlete is. Now, your approach is a little bit different. We're really not improving FTP per se, but what we're doing, we've talked about the same thing with Steve Neal, is we're changing the percentage of FTP that we can utilize burning just fats.
Right.
Okay, so that's how I'm going to ask you this question. So let's say you've got your typical athlete that comes in and they start, you know, it's a male with a 300 watt FTP and he starts burning carbohydrates around 100 watts. Let's just use that as an example. I don't know how long it's going to take you, but let's say you got a year to train this guy, modify his diet. How many watts can you add to his crossover point in a year?
So I will tell you this, because I measure this, right? And I actually geek out a little bit on this and not necessarily sharing it with athletes every so often. But I have actually seen in some cyclists, you know, I always keep these, what's the highest I've seen in my testing? From a cycling perspective, and this was not a pro cyclist by any means, more of a competitive recreational, I've actually seen an improvement in 28% fat oxidation. Now, again, to your point, it's taken months to do that, so extrapolating that into your numbers, but I've seen that number be as high as 28% for a cyclist, a little bit higher for a runner,
So if they were at 100 watts, they got to 128?
Correct. I mean, it's more robust the higher your FTP, obviously.
Okay. So do you have like an example number? So the guy started at what crossover point and got to where?
It was like right around 250. I can't remember exactly. So 250, give or take like 10 watts. So that pushed him well over 300 watts for his metabolic efficiency point.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's like your typical, you know, competitive recreational rider.
Okay, perfect.
But that's awesome. What we were talking about earlier is, you know, moving that metabolic efficiency point closer to the FTP or LT.
Amazing.
Yep.
All right. This has been an awesome episode. We've had a lot. People love nutrition episodes, obviously, because they're a great topic. Yeah. And we had somebody write a long time ago to say not to forget about this type of topic. And I knew nothing about it. I read all of your books. So
thank you.
I want to say that all three of your books that I read, you have the metabolic efficiency point or training, you have the diet or the recipe book, and then you have periodized remind me of the title. Periodization.
Nutrition Periodization for Athletes.
There it is. Yes.
Yep.
All great books. So if you're listening to this and you want to learn more about it, definitely start there. Mm-hmm. You also offer a lot of services at Energy, at your business. So yep. Talk a little bit about your business, how we can find out more about you, and how listeners can come to you and get tested if that's something they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we mentioned earlier, I'm based in Colorado, right outside of Denver. So I actually have a lot of athletes fly in the night before we do the test the next morning. But my one of my businesses is Energy Performance, ENRG Performance. And I've owned it for many, many moons. I have myself and a team of sport dietitians. And this is what we do. Like my whole focus has been my entire career, sport nutrition for athletes. And, I gravitated at a younger age into an endurance athlete. And, I've done Leadville a couple times, running, cycling, and triathlon, and obstacle course racing, like you name it, right? So we specialize in endurance athletes and sport nutrition for endurance athletes. We don't do any hospital stuff, like none of that stuff. So that, in addition to, I've used the physiology person of who I am also in my experience, my education, to offer a full battery of physiological testing. Obviously, my specialty is metabolic efficiency testing, but still do some LT testing, do a lot of biomarker testing, adrenal stress, genomics testing, blood work testing. So really, I've crafted my business, Energy Performance, as a physiologist, sport dietitian based, not just one or the other. And I think that's what's really unique about what I've been doing the past 25 years.
Yeah. Well, really cool stuff.
Yeah. You can go to the website, ENRGperformance.com. You could just Google my name too. I'm everywhere. So pretty easy to find.
You are.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Well, like I said, great episode. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
This has been
definitely going to be a hit. Yeah. So thank you so much. And we will definitely talk soon.
All right. I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. Hey, this is Chris with Flow. When we're not producing this podcast, our team at Flow is designing some of the fastest carbon fiber bicycle wheels in the world. As a thank you for being a listener of our podcast, Faster by Flow, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase of wheels at flowcycling.com. Head over to our website and pick up a set of wheels to make you faster at your next race or ride. Simply use coupon code PODCAST, that's PODCAST, in all uppercase letters when checking out to get 20% off your order. Thanks again for listening to Faster. We hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to check out episode 32 with equipment manufacturer Nick Salazar from TriRig. In this episode, we discuss the difference between rim brakes and disc brakes, wheels, frame design, and aero bar design. If you are wondering how your equipment can make you faster, this episode is for you. If you enjoy the show, please help us by sharing our podcast and by leaving a rating or review. If you want to learn more about our company, Flow Cycling, please visit us online at flowcycling.com. That's F as in Frank, LOCYCLING.com. You can also find us under Flow Cycling on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, ride safe.